Good morning, Harmony. Why don't you rise in body and spirit and worship with us this morning? Here we go.
Let the glory of the Lord rise among us. Let the glory of the Lord rise among us. Let the praises of the King rise among us. Let it rise. Let it rise.
Let the song.
Let the songs of the Lord rise among us. Let the songs of the Lord rise among us. Let the joy of the King rise among us. Let it rise. Let it rise.
Take all that is wrong and make it right. stand, I will stand my ground. I will stand my ground.
I will stand my ground.
You're never gonna let me down.
It's not who you are.
No.
I can just sit and wait for all your goodness, hope to feel your presence. And I can just stay right where I am and hope to feel you, hope to feel something again. I could hold on to who I am and never let you change me from the inside. And I could be safe here in your arms and never leave home, never let these walls down. But you have called me higher, you have called me deeper, and I'll go. You have called me higher, you have called me deeper, and I'll go where you will lead me, Lord, you lead me. You lead me, Lord. And I could hold on to who I am and never let you change me from the inside. And I could be safe here in your arms and never leave home, never let these walls down. But you have called me higher, you have called me deeper. You have called me higher, you have called me deeper, and I'll go where you will lead me, Lord, you lead me. You lead me, Lord. And I will be yours, oh, I will be yours for all my life.
Let's hear it again for our band. It's amazing. And Melinda. So good morning again. It's good to be with you. My name is Pastor Bridie Roberts, and I serve as an associate pastor here at Harmony Toluca Lake. I'm only on quarter time, but that quarter time is here with you, and I hope that I will continue to grow with you and grow my ministry here in the space. My full-time work during the week is as a director of community organizing for a labor union. A labor union that works with very low-wage workers in the hotel and restaurant and food service industries. And my work is to connect my faith and to connect to the faith of the people that we work with and help them enter into a shared struggle to achieve justice for people. Now, this is something that I didn't necessarily learn in my church growing up. What I learned was that Jesus called us to justice, and I felt that the call to justice was absolutely in keeping with the teachings that I was being shown, but we never really broke it down. It was more like, God wants us to do good things. Jesus tells us to love our neighbor. Now go out and do it. Now, I've been very lucky because the congregation that raised me, First United Methodist Church of Des Moines, Iowa, and the congregations that I have served since, including Pico Union Shalom Ministries, Alhambra First United Methodist, Venice, and La Puente, and also Hollywood, have all taken that spark inside me and told me to follow it. Part of what led me in this path was my understanding of what it meant to be a person of faith. And one of the great icons of our century, of the 20th century, who brought many people into social justice was Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And as a young girl, I wondered how it was that he could do the things that he was called to do and have the strength that he had to do the things that he had to do and still live both within the boundaries of our world and the church. Dr. King was a revelatory man, a deep intellect, a person of faith, and he wasn't even 40 years old before his life was ended shortly. He built his tradition of nonviolence and soul force upon the teachings of others that came before him and who did the important work of changing the world. In the early 20th century, Mahatma Gandhi developed a powerful new tool for change that he called satyagraha, a Sanskrit word which means something akin to holding onto the truth. Based on the Hindu scripture of ahimsa, it basically means to follow into a path of nonviolence that is not just resistance to the words and actions of violence, but to be choosing a path of intention that involves truthfulness, kindness, and love, the way that we interact with other people. I'm sorry I'm playing with my tablet so much, but I just put it on saver mode, and now that means it turns off every minute. So if there is a person here who can fix that for me, I would most appreciate that. So let me know if you're out there. I could just go without a transcript because that's how I roll anyway. But I want to get the quotes right. Okay. You want to try? Thank you. Just put it back on power draining mode. That's fine. Mahatma Gandhi lived in a time and in a nation that was under the greatest colonializing rule in the world. And the people of India were suffering. Many people believe that the only way to remove the British from their continent was through violence. But he knew that that was not a possibility. That the people would never achieve the peace and the future that they wanted or they deserved if they rose up in violence. And he leaned into the ancient traditions of Hinduism and other faiths from the Eastern continents that really formed his ideas about nonviolence. But he also looked to Christianity, and particularly to the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, which we will explore today, because Jesus was also a teacher for Gandhi. He has said in his writings that, in fact, Christ is the seed for nonviolence in his work, and that the gospel work that is present in the Beatitudes helps create the platform for those who are going to go out and approach this work by choosing to work with love, to change the way that we behave, and to move forward without violence. Now, this is something that's easy to preach on 70 years later. But at the time that Gandhi and his nonviolent movement were fighting for their freedom, They may have chose nonviolence, but the state did not. And people died on the path. It was these teachings that Gandhi lived into, that his followers lived into, that helped inspire Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King's teachings of soul force. Now I'm going to explain that a little bit. Tomorrow is the birthday of Dr. King. He would have been 91 years old. Yesterday I was at a breakfast celebrating his life with the Los Angeles labor movement, and Senator Kamala Harris was there. And she invited us to imagine what Dr. King would be doing at the age of 91 if he was still alive. Would he be watching from the sidelines? If he was living in this moment, in this political moment, in this social moment, would he feel that his work was done? Would he be watching cable news late at night and railing at the TV? She was pretty sure, as I am, that we would not find him in his armchair, but probably outside in some super supportive sneakers, right? On the picket line with people younger than him. And as I sat there and contemplated that, I was really forced to recall an editorial that I read in the Charlotte Observer that they've run every year for the past 3 years. That questions, would we love King the same way if he had lived? Because during his day, his call to nonviolent resistance, love revolution, and social change was not beloved by the political establishment. It was not welcome in all the churches. The hearts of people were not ready for the invitation to change that they were extended. If his life had not been taken in such a brutal and horrendous way, would we have holidays or would we have revolution? I'm not sure. But what I do know is that his life still gives us the opportunity to seek change and to pursue a new way of understanding our work. Now, when I first saw the term soul force, right, I imagined something a little bit more funky, a little bit more like that opening song that we had today, a lot of bass, right? Something kind of catchy. Soul force is an understanding of nonviolent change that looks to Gandhi, but explicitly, even more explicitly, embraces the Christian values that we find in the gospel. Soul force is the guiding power that leads us to be engaged in the work of challenging the broken structures of the world around us, but intentionally through nonviolent means. Soul force is not just choosing to refrain from violence. It's not pacifism. It's not stepping away. Soul force is choosing to act. It's choosing to intentionally live into the love, kindness, respect, and truthfulness that is required of those who are seeking to be made into a new person, to be born afresh in God, and to live into a world that represents what Jesus has called us to do. Now, this is no easy task. King often called on those who followed to resist the forces of physical violence and instead embrace the forces of love, to live into a soul force, to allow it to guide each in our everydays, our movements, our passions, because there was a deep and necessary acknowledgement that the way that we live matters. Nonviolence isn't just choosing not to lift your hand in anger. It's about the words that you use. It's about how you choose to relate to one another. It's about how you engage in the concept and the act of forgiveness. It's about the kind of world that you want to build, because the ends are defined by the means. If you achieve something at the end of your work for change by using the tools of those who would oppress you, then you are already infecting what you have come out with those same tools. It's much harder to choose the pathway of love. It's much harder to make ourselves vulnerable to the movement of God in our lives, to give up a piece of our power and our struggle, and to let God change us and influence us, and to lift it up into God's hands. Today we have the set of scriptures from the Sermon on the Mount that helped inspire this movement, that helped inform it and helped shape it. And I'm going to invite Jace to come up and share with us the Beatitudes.
Now when Jesus, I'll just talk loud. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up to the mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Matthew 5, 1 through 12.
Thank you. So you know these verses, right? Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the meek. We often hear them one at a time, used to describe a certain person in a certain situation, or to kind of try and apply some understanding to our inability to fathom the suffering in the world. In fact, the early church, the orthodoxy of the early church, was scared of the revolutionary and radical nature of these texts. And they taught that these were aspirational. And yet, many of the Beatitudes can be historically traced to the original sources back to Jesus, to his very own words. And they weren't delivered one by one in choice settings. The Beatitudes are delivered together, not as a set of potential guiding principles for your future, but as an address to people in his community who had chosen to live this way, to turn their back on the values and the cultures of the community and society that they were living in, on the thirst for power, on greed, on hunger for things which were beyond their reach, and instead to choose to live together with intentionality. This was a difficult path both for the disciples and for the early Christians who came after them, and it was radical. People were there to live into Jesus, to be inspired to not only change the lives of the world around them, but to change their lives. And the Beatitudes are a naming of how people are living in this moment and what is to come afterwards. Blessed are the poor. Now, Matthew adds "in spirit." I'm not sure why. Maybe he was feeling a little anxious. But the Q source says, "Blessed are the poor." Early Christians gave up what they had to live collectively, together. They turned their back on the idea that more is more and instead lived into what less could bring you. They were persecuted. They welcomed people inside their communities who others rejected. They lifted up women. They lifted up enslaved people. They lifted up all kinds of people in their mix who were rejected by those who felt that they had a better understanding of what was proper or holy. They built radical communities of inclusion and change and chose to live that way for the first 5 centuries of Christianity. These people were called the people of the way. And Diana Butler Bass has a great book where she talks about this. And if you ever want to do a little Googling on ancient Christian history, look up Justin Martyr, because he talks about what it means to choose to live collectively, to live into the Beatitudes, to live into a way of life that is not just because Jesus calls you there, because it changes you and transforms you and opens up new doors and new ideas. We are living in a time when many forms of violent and aggressive power are being wielded. It's not political rhetoric. This is the news. We see ourselves at the brink of war. We see ourselves challenged by nuclear proliferation around the world. The rhetoric of leadership in our nation is expressed through a lot of machismo, a lot of anger, a lot of insistence on power and might. Not very often is the conversation lifted about how love can transform and change. These forces are at play, and they're very real, and they have very real costs. We live in one of the wealthiest cities on the continent. And yet every night in Los Angeles, more than 55,000 people find themselves unhoused and on the streets. At the same time, a recent study came out that said that there were more vacant homes and apartments in the city than people living on the street. That's something that we have to pray about and we have to question. We are living in a time where the power that is wielded says that it is okay to confine women and children and to separate families who are seeking asylum, who are fleeing from violence, and to not even provide them with their most basic needs of hygiene or food at our border. Where there's a rhetoric around political power around that, instead of a deep question about what it means to be a country of the free, where we welcome people who are suffering. As people of faith, we know, I mean, I know I'm preaching to the choir here a little bit, right? These things are on our hearts, right? Like, I'm not preaching any kind of new news to you. The question is, like, what can we do about it? How can we live into it? What is our call? I want to invite you to take a moment and imagine what it would mean to live the Beatitude life. What in your life and in your heart could be changed so that this idea that blessed are they is not about they, but about us? The early faith community, the people of Jesus, the followers of Christ who the Beatitudes speak to, they made a choice to be in community with each other, much the way that we are in intentional community with each other in this place. Last week, we had a very special service. What did we do? We remembered our baptism, right? We repeated our baptismal vows. And at the core of baptism in our church is that it happens in community. Rev Dave is not going to run off with someone doing individual baptism by the river, right? Neither am I or Pastor Mark. We do baptism in community because it is a communal work to walk in faith. We welcomed Eleanor Min into our church through baptism last Sunday. She's right there. And we promised her that we would walk beside her. And when we renewed our covenant of baptism last Sunday, we restated what baptism means to us, what it means to our church, and what it means to be together, building a faith community in relationship. Dr. King passed away. He was taken from us too many years ago, but his legacy continues and his words remain real. I just want to share a quote with you that was shared with me. This was delivered in West Germany at a church outside the Berlin Wall. And he says, "On either side of the wall are God's children, and no man-made barrier can obliterate that fact." 60 years ago. And yet we're still talking about walls and the separation of people. But we should not lose heart. When we see our neighbors on the street, we should not give up hope. We have been given all that we need to do the work that God calls us to do. We are not asked to solve all the issues of the world, to take on climate change, to take on trafficking, to solve all those things by ourselves. What we are asked to do is to live each day in faith, to surrender to God that we don't have the answers, but we'd like to be a part of the solution, and to love deeply, to be in relationship with each other, to understand each other, to forgive each other, to let the little slights pass us by so that together we can build a true soul force. We can live into a spirit of change. We can embrace nonviolence. I am going to ask you in a few minutes to do a piece of homework together to close our time. But before I do that, I want to share with you something that was in your bulletin. We all see this? We are writing a book, our church, Hollywood and Harmony Toluca Lake. We are including the stories of our community and how they have been impacted, both in forms of harm and healing, through our larger church's failure to open its doors inclusively to all people and LGBT people. We're lifting up these stories because this is a powerful way to speak truth to power, to bring out the places where folks have been harmed, but also the places where love has healed people. I will be writing a story for this book. I'm only going to give you a little glimpse of it now because I want you to read the book when we're done. But when I was 13 years old, I had been attending my church regularly for several years. I was a church kid. I showed up every Sunday. I was in the youth group. I was in a Sunday school class. I was in a Wednesday night confirmation class. I showed up at church to volunteer on like Tuesday and Thursday. I took naps in the library. I basically lived there. And I had a very close relationship with my pastor, Wayne Churchman, which is a great name for like an older Methodist pastor from the Midwest. And he was a wonderful guy, right? At the same time, my world was expanding. I lived in Sioux City, Iowa, which is a small town. It's like 60,000 people. And someone had told me, oh, you belong to the conservative church. And I was like, no, I don't, because my church had told me that Jesus was about justice and had encouraged me to go out and do justice. And they're like, oh, no, the Unitarians, the UUCs, everyone else is, you're on the right side of the spectrum. And I had no idea what they were talking about because that was not the lived experience that I had had. I was a theater kid also, and when I was in the sixth grade, I made friends with a boy named Shannon. He went to a different middle school, but we went to the same theater camp every summer. And in the eighth grade, he came out to me. Before he could come out to his family or his friends or other folks, and I'm not outing him now because let me tell you, he has a big Facebook life and profile, so you can find out whatever you want to find out about. He lives in Las Vegas. He has a big life. He was in deep pain. This was in the early 90s, because there was no place for him, and he was terrified to tell his parents. But he told me, and he said he didn't feel welcomed by the church. And I said, well, I think my church would welcome you. And he said, are you sure? So 13 years old, my second year of confirmation class, a month away from confirmation, my mom ordered my twin sister and I beautiful white in dresses from the JCPenney catalog. I went to visit Reverend Churchman, who I had visited many times before. And I said, Reverend Churchman, I'm very confused. I'm hearing these things about our church. My best friend Shannon is gay, and he's scared, but he doesn't feel like he can come here. What does our church say about homosexuality? Now, as a pastor now, I understand more Reverend Churchman's response at that time, because I think he did not know how to respond. But as a young person of faith, what happened next broke my heart open in ways that I have still struggled with. He pulled the book of discipline off the shelf. 30 years later. He opened it. And he read that passage. We do not condemn, but we do not condone. That's all. No hatred, no virile conversation, but not what I needed or what I was looking for, that God is love, and this is the house of love, and all are welcome here. It has been a lifetime of learning that the rules of institution, the rules of the land, even the rules of our government, are not always to be adhered when they violate the law of God and the law of love. My story will be in this book, and if you have stories, I hope you will bring them, because my story is also a story of healing. That through my understanding of what it meant to be a follower of Christ, through my understanding of Jesus explained in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Beatitudes, but even better, through my understanding of who Jesus is, through Jesus' followers, I learned that even though my institution struggled, the church is a place where all people are welcome and loved. And it took me a long time to walk that path, and sometimes I still, you know, get a little bit of a... Soul Force is alive. It's alive in our denomination as we struggle for change and transformation, and we're willing to break free from the bonds that have held us in order to make something new. Soul Force is alive when you see people walking the streets and counting and engaging with our unhoused friends. Soul Force is alive when you see churches going to the border to pray at the border and offer communion with people who are held there. We are alive through faith. And so now I want to invite you to take 1 minute and to close your eyes. Earlier, I asked you to think about a place where justice speaks to your heart and where your faith connects to it. And now I want you to zero in on one thing that you will do this month that allows you to answer that call, that passion that's been placed inside of you. One thing, one simple thing. Open your eyes. Now I want you to turn to your neighbor, because God's love revolution happens in community. And I want you to tell them what you're going to do this month. Go ahead and do that. I know. Right now you're like, what? Look, we got a lot of things going on here. You can plug in or make up your own. If you need to think about it and come back next week with it, that's fine. But we want to check in with each other and help each other walk this path of faith. All right, let's say a word of prayer. Gracious and loving God, we lift up these intentions on our hearts, and we hope that you will help us make them flesh, that we can live into the call that you've placed on us, and that we will not be overwhelmed or overcome by the harm in the world, because the power of your love is so much greater. And you have made us the vessel of that love and the instrument of it as well. In your name we pray. Amen.
Please stand and pass the peace of Christ with your neighbor before we sing this last song.
Please remember to join us in the fellowship hall afterwards for lunch with your community.
At break of day, in hope we rise, we speak your name, we lift our eyes, tune our hearts into your beat. Where we walk, there you'll be, with fire in our eyes, our lives alight. Your love untamed is blazing out, the streets will glow forever bright, your glory's breaking through the night. You will
peace. Please join us in the fellowship hall for community lunch.